You want Black Friday prices without the Black Friday crowds. Lowe's gets it. We checked the calendar, and Christmas is coming early. $99 is all you need to grab your favorite select 7-foot pre-lit artificial Christmas tree for the holiday season. And don't sweat what gifts to get Dad, because we've got up to 40% off select tools and accessories. That's how Lowe's celebrates Black Friday early. Selection varies by location while supplies last.
Welcome to the Deep Dive, your shortcut to, well, getting under the skin of the figures and ideas shaping our culture, even the ones, maybe especially the ones, who are quietly reshaping things from the underground up.
And today we're tackling a big one, an American cartoonist you might recognize the name of, but whose career arc, it's something else entirely. We're talking about Peter Bagg.
That's Bagg, pronounced like the word bag, B-A. Good to get that right up front, because understanding this guy, this underground legend, it starts there.
Yeah, Peter Bagg, born 1957. He's really famous for this totally unique visual style he has. It's like a mix of really dark black humor with these incredibly exaggerated, almost frantic cartoons.
Hyperkinetic, I think, is the word often used.
Exactly. It looks like pure anxiety just slashed onto the page.
So what we really want to dig into today is, you know, how did he make this huge shift? How did the guy who basically defined the whole grunge era slacker thing, you know, the reduced expectations of middle class American youth?
Right. And stuff like Need Stuff and especially Hate. That was his big one.
Exactly. Hate. How did that guy pivot? How did he become this leading voice in really meticulous, fact-based comics? Stuff like journalism, biographies, history.
It's honestly one of the most fascinating turns in like modern comics history.
Yeah.
His early stuff, the fiction. It got him so much attention, so much cultural weight. Remember those two Harvey Awards back in 91?
Yeah, Best Cartoonist and Best New Series for Hate. That was a big deal.
Huge. But now, fast forward to the 21st century, the same hand that drew Buddy Bradley freaking out. It's drawing, like, detailed science histories for Discover Magazine.
And doing political commentary for Reason, writing these big graphic novel biographies. It's gone from being this voice of a generation to almost like a historical documentarian.
It's quite the journey.
Okay, so let's unpack that. Let's go back. Trace the roots of that style, that kinetic energy. He was born December 11, 1957, Peekskill, New York. Grew up in the NYC suburbs.
And you really have to start there with the childhood environment to get where that nervous energy comes from.
Right. What do we know about that?
Well, from his own words, it sounds complicated, maybe a bit chaotic. His dad was military.
Yeah.
And he described his Catholic household having lots of drunken fights about money.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. And he said that whole situation basically made them the weirdo outcast kids of the neighborhood. That feeling, you know, being the outsider, maybe a bit alienated.
That seems crucial. It feels like the engine behind so many of his characters, especially Buddy Bradley.
Absolutely. That sort of inherent alienation, always feeling like you're outside the norm, it drives the psychology.
And even the little personal details are fascinating, aren't they? Like his confirmation name.
Oh, yeah.
Peter Christian Paul Bagg. And the Paul part, it's an homage to Paul McCartney.
No way. Seriously. Yeah. Yeah. So right there, you've got this mix, right? Deep personal fandom, suburban religious background, and this undercurrent of needing something else, an escape, maybe.
That search for escape, for definition, it naturally pulls him towards the city. New York City, mid-1970s. That's where the action was.
He dipped his toe into formal education, right? School of Visual Arts, briefly. Three semesters in 77. But he figured out pretty quick that wasn't his path. Dropped out.
And went straight into.
Straight into the thick of it.
Yeah.
Working on Punk Magazine.
Yeah.
Plunging right into that raw sort of anti-establishment scene.
And that really sets the tone, doesn't it? Working for Punk. It leads him right into the comics underground. Early 80s. He's doing what a lot of aspiring artists did back then.
Yeah, contributing wherever he could. Underground newspapers, famously. Even pornography magazines. It was a kind of necessary apprenticeship, right?
Right.
Gritty, but common for the time.
But this is where the key connection happens. The one that really changes things for him.
Right. He teams up with some old punk magazine folks, John Holmstrom included. They put out this short-lived comics tabloid, Comical Funnies. 1980, 81.
A real DIY effort.
Totally. And here's the kicker. Bagg just sends copies to R. Crumb.
The R. Crumb, the godfather of underground comics.
The man himself just sends him copies.
That takes guts.
It really does. And guess what? It worked. Crumb liked it. Liked Bagged's stuff enough to start publishing his strips in Weirdo.
Weirdo magazine. That was huge. A massive platform in that world.
Oh, absolutely. And Bag became a real fixture there. Did a lot of strips, often illustrating stories by Dave Corino.
Yeah.
But the real symbolic moment, that came in 84.
What happened then?
Crumb was ready to step back from editing Weirdo.
Mm-hmm.
And he handed the reins to Peter Bag.
Wow. That's not just a job offer. That's like a coronation.
It really was. A passing of the torch, you know. From that first generation of underground legends to the next wave, the alternative scene, Bag edited it for 3 really important years, stepped away, then came back for 1 guest issue in 89.
So editing Weirdo cemented his place as a voice, but his style, the way his drawings looked, that's what made him totally original. Well, let's talk about that elastic kinetic art style.
Yeah, you see a Bag panel, you know it's Bag. The characters... They look like they're about to just fly apart, all limbs and bulging eyes.
So where does that come from? It's so distinctive.
Okay, this is the surprising part. He traces it back directly to his childhood obsession with 1940s Warner Brothers cartoons.
Looney Tunes.
Seriously.
Specifically, the ones directed by Bob Clampett. That's the DNA. That's the source code for all that manic energy on the page.
That feels counterintuitive. His characters feel so modern, so cynical, like pure 90s angst. But the technique comes from classic, almost joyful animation.
That's the genius of it, isn't it? He took that Clampett energy, the stretching, the squash and stretch, the sheer speed, and tried to capture it.
In a static drawing.
Exactly, on a comic book page. He said his goal was to get that sense of movement and exaggeration into a format where things don't actually move.
So the characters look like they're vibrating, like their bodies can't contain their own anxiety.
Precisely. That frantic, almost painful elasticity.
Yeah.
It became the perfect visual language for the kind of characters he was drawing. People full of tension, dealing with, like we said, those reduced expectations. It wasn't just funny drawing. It was drawing internal chaos.
A visual metaphor for the times. Okay, so he's got the style, he's got the underground cred, then comes the long-term home for that vision, Fantagraphics.
Right. He starts his long association with Fantagraphics in 1985. And that's where his first solo series launches. Neat stuff.
Neat stuff. 1985 to 89, this was like the laboratory, right? Where he developed his whole universe.
Absolutely. All the key players start showing up here. You've got Girly Girl Jr., Studs Kirby.
The Bradleys. That wonderfully dysfunctional family.
Them too. And crucially, the guy who would come to define Bag's work for the next decade, Buddy Bradley.
For anyone wanting to track those origins, the Neat Stuff material got collected later, right? The Bradleys, Studs Kirby Jr., and other losers.
Yeah, those collections pulled the key storylines together. But the real earthquake was the sequel series, the one everyone knows, Hate.
Hate. Launched in 1990, ran till 98. This was the 90s alternative comic, wasn't it?
Pretty much. It just hit the nail on the head. It captured the whole zeitgeist perfectly.
Whether Buddy was stuck back in Jersey or, you know, famously moved out to Seattle.
Right in the heart of Grunge Central.
He was the absolute icon of that post-Reagan disappointment. Terrible jobs, awful apartments, messy relationships. Just this overwhelming feeling that life wasn't adding up.
That theme you mentioned, the reduced expectations of middle-class American youth, Hate just drilled down on it with this incredibly sharp black humor.
And it got noticed. Big time. We already mentioned the Harvey Awards in 91. Best new series for Hate, best cartoonist for Bag himself.
And it wasn't just a flash in the pan. That quality, that relevance, it lasted the whole decade. The source material points out Hate was getting Harvey nominations almost every single year from 1990 right through to 1999.
That's incredible consistency. It shows it wasn't just trendy. It was consistently seen as top-tier work by his peers.
And Buddy Bradley himself became this international figure in a way. Mm. He won the UK Comic Art Award for Best Character in 91. People connected with him everywhere.
Even after the main series ended in 98, Buddy lived on, right?
Yeah, Bag kept checking in on him with the Hate annuals. Those came out between 2000 and 2010. Fans loved them.
And for anyone wanting the definitive experience now, there's the Complete Hate. Okay. Came out in 2020.
Right, collected everything. All 40 original issues plus the annuals. A massive undertaking.
And that collection itself won an Eisner Award in 2021. Best Archival Collection. Which is kind of perfect, isn't it? The ultimate slacker comic gets the ultimate historical preservation award.
It really does validate it as this key cultural document. But here's the thing. Just as Buddy's story was kind of winding down in those annuals, Bagg was already deep into that major pivot we talked about, the shift towards fact-based work.
Yeah, this is where his career path gets really fascinating, because it wasn't like flipping a switch from fiction to nonfiction. There was this intense period of experimentation first.
Right. He really dives into comics journalism, started around 98, maybe a piece for Details magazine, but it really ramps up between 2000 and 2002.
And he was writing while drawing about everything.
He was incredibly prolific and showing right away that his style could work for reporting. He covered a ton of stuff, mostly for that early, really influential website, Suck.com.
What kind of topics?
Oh, all sorts. Politics, the weirdness of bar culture. He went to the Miss America pageant, looked at Christian rock, the Oscars, just applying that Bag lens to real world stuff.
So using that same frantic, exaggerated style, but now to observe reality instead of Buddy's internal state, it gave this unique, cynical take on modern life.
Mm-hmm. And he wasn't just on Suck.com. He was doing short pieces from AD Magazine, too. And he had a regular strip in the Weekly World News.
The Weekly World News. Seriously. Bat Boy.
Adventures of Bat Boy. He did like 100 of them. They collected it all in 2011. It's just his range, even doing tabloid parody.
Okay, so during this phase, experimenting with journalism parody, he also brushed up against the mainstream superhero world.
Yeah, a couple of notable projects. He did his take on Spider-Man for Marvel back in 2002.
And wasn't there a Hulk story? One that got kind of lost?
Yes. The Incorrigible Hulk. Great story behind that. Bagg finished the whole thing, totally infused with his style. But then, management changed at Marvel.
Oh, no.
Yeah, the project got shelved, just sat there, unreleased for years.
Mm-hmm.
Classic corporate chaos, messing with creator vision.
Did it ever see the light of day?
Thankfully, yes. It finally got serialized in 2009 in a miniseries called Strange Tales Under the Marvel Knights imprint. So you can actually see Bagg's Hulk now. It's wild.
Good to know it wasn't lost forever. He worked with DC too, right?
He did. Wrote a series called, From 99 to 2000, All Ages book about an all-girl rock band drawn by the amazing Gilbert Hernandez.
Oh, wow. That's a team up.
Right.
Yeah.
And then in 2003, he did Sweatshop for DC. And this one was interesting technically because, unlike Hate, where he did almost everything, Sweatshop used an art team. Guys like Jim Blanchard, Bill Ray.
Oh, so exploring collaboration, too. Sweatshop was about the comics industry itself, wasn't it? Ran for 6 issues.
Yeah, bit of meta commentary there. So you see him just testing all these boundaries. Mainstream, all ages, art teams, journalism, satire. But look closely at his fiction from around the mid-2000s.
Okay.
You start to see the pull towards history, towards research, becoming really strong.
How so?
Take Apocalypse Nerd. Ran from 2005 to 2007, the main story. Classic Bag. Two average guys trying to survive after a nuclear attack hits the Pacific Northwest. Cynical, funny, bleak.
That sounds about right.
But here's the key detail. The backup stories in Apocalypse Nerd. The sources confirmed they were historically researched anecdotal tales of America's founding fathers.
There it is. The research bug biting. Right there in the back pages of his fiction.
Exactly. It feels like a dry run for the biographies to come. Then he followed that with Other Lives in 2010, which was super ahead of its time, looking at how people's real lives and online lives clash.
Very relevant now.
And Reset in 2012, about a washed-up actor reliving his life virtually. So still exploring modern anxieties.
Right.
But that definitive shift, it really locks in with his science history work.
Right, for Discover Magazine, starting in 2009.
Yeah, and this wasn't just a one-off. It became a regular gig, a continuing series of comics about the history of science. Applying that unmistakable Bag style, the energy, the exaggerate, not to Buddy Bradley, but to, you know, key scientists and moments in scientific discovery.
So he's proving the comics medium can handle this, right? It's not just for subjective angst. It can be for rigorous factual storytelling, too.
Absolutely. He's using caricature and dynamic layouts to make potentially dry historical facts engaging, memorable.
Which leads us squarely into the next major phase. The biography triptych. This feels like a really significant turn, focusing on these major historical women.
It really is. A huge shift away from the male-centric world of Hate towards these deep, complex, historically grounded profiles of important and often controversial female figures.
The first one was Woman Rebel, the Margaret Sanger story, 2013.
Correct. About the birth control advocate. And Sanger is not a simple figure. Her story is full of social upheaval, legal fights, ethical complexities. Mm-hmm. Bagg had to bring his style to bear on really serious, nuanced history.
And it worked, critically speaking.
It definitely did. Woman Rebel got an Eisner nomination in 2014 for Best Reality-Based Work. This huge validation. It showed he'd successfully made the transition and was being recognized for it.
Then came Zora Neale Hurston.
Fire. The Zora Neale Hurston story, 2017. profiling the incredible writer, anthropologist, icon of the Harlem Renaissance. Again, navigating really complex cultural history, literary impact, biographical detail. The research had to be spot on.
And the third in the series.
Credo, the Rose Wilder Lane story from 2019. Lane, the author, political thinker, daughter of Laura Ingalls Wilder, and a really key figure in the development of American libertarian thought.
Okay, so these aren't just simple biographies. They're tackling figures with really significant, sometimes contentious legacies.
Exactly. And he brings that same meticulous research approach he honed on the science strips to these lives. It shows this commitment to presenting the facts, even about controversial people, which naturally connects to his own political identity.
Right. We should touch on that. Bagg's been openly libertarian for a long time, and it often surfaces in his work, usually through that cynical observational humor.
Yeah, especially since 2003, when he started contributing to Reason Magazine, the libertarian publication. He does prose pieces and comics commentary for them.
So, looking at his politics, the sources paint a picture of someone pretty independent-minded.
Very. And we should just report this impartially because it does shed light on his perspective. You can see why he captured that alienated 90s vibe and maybe why he's drawn to complex figures. For instance, he strongly opposed the Iraq War, very critical of George W. Bush.
But his voting record isn't straight ticket libertarian, is it?
Not at all. It's fascinatingly pragmatic, or maybe contrarian. In 2000, yes, he voted for the libertarian candidate, Harry Brown.
Okay.
But then in 2004, he voted for Democrat John Kerry. His stated reason, simply, I wanted to fire Bush.
So strategic voting over ideological purity there.
It was like it.
Yeah.
And 2008 was similar. He talked about voting for Bob Barr, the libertarian, as a protest. Unless the polls were close in his state, then maybe Obama to stop McCain, who he saw as incompetent.
So what does he end up doing?
He confirmed later in Reason that he did vote for Barr. And he added, kind of defiantly, I stand by that vote more now than I did then.
Interesting. It definitely suggests someone who values independent thought and distrusts established power more than sticking to one party line.
Exactly. And that critical, skeptical viewpoint is what fuels his comics journalism and, you know, arguably informs how he approaches these complex historical biographies.
A lot of that political work, especially the Reason strips, got collected, didn't it?
Yep. In a 2009 book called Everybody is Stupid Except for Me. And other astute observations.
The title says it all, really.
It perfectly captures that specific brand of Bagg cynicism, whether he's aiming it at Buddy Bradley's world or Washington, D.C.
And we should quickly mention his wife, Joanne, is a key part of the process, right?
Especially later on.
Absolutely. She does a lot of the coloring work on his publications, including the biographies. It's very much a collaborative effort behind the scenes.
Okay, so let's pull back and look at the overall recognition. This career. It's not just about hate. It's about sustained impact across different genres for decades. The longevity is really impressive. We mentioned the early RVs in 91, but those 9 subsequent years of hate nominations, that shows real staying power.
And the Eisner Awards track his whole journey, nominations for writing and drawing hate in the 90s.
Then the nomination for Woman Rebel as reality-based work in 2014.
And finally, the win for the Complete Hate Archive in 2021. His career arc is literally mapped out in those awards.
Plus international recognition, like that UK Comic Art Award back in 1990. And the Inkpot Award in 2010 from Comic-Con, which is basically a lifetime achievement award for comics and related fields.
And it goes beyond just comics awards, too. He's gotten major institutional recognition.
Yeah, like being named a Rockefeller Fellow for Literature and receiving a United States Artists Award in 2014. That's serious validation, placing comics firmly in the realm of legitimate literature and art.
His influence also spilled over into other media, even if briefly. Animation.
Right, he did those animated commercials for Round Table Pizza. His style just lends itself to movement.
And wasn't there an early internet cartoon?
Yeah. Back in 2001, working with comedian Dana Gould, it was a Macromedia Flash cartoon called Murray Wilson, Rock Enroll Dad, for Icebox.com.
Wow, early web animation. So he was experimenting there too, just like with journalism.
He seems to always be exploring the edges. And don't forget music.
Oh yeah, he was in bands.
Played drums in a Seattle power pop band, The Action Suits, and guitar in another one. Can you imagine? That kinetic energy, it wasn't just in the drawings.
It makes sense. A restless creative energy. And finally, people are starting to study him seriously, academically.
Definitely. Tomorrow's Publishing did a whole book on him in their Comics Introspective series back in 2007. And the University Press of Mississippi published Peter Badge, Conversations in 2015, collecting 30 years of interviews. his legacy is being documented.
So wrapping this all up, the core story here is that transition, isn't it? From nailing that counterculture frustration in fiction
to meticulously documenting history and biography, all while keeping that same signature over-the-top kinetic style. He basically proved comics could do both raw satire and rigorous fact.
So the takeaway for you, the listener, Bagg's career is exhibit A for the flexibility of the comics medium. It can handle deeply personal anarchic humor and serious historical research, complex political ideas, all within one artist's very recognizable voice. You don't have to change your style to change your subject matter.
Which leaves us with a final thought for you to chew on. Remember, way back at the beginning, we talked about his goal, capturing that wild Bob Clampett cartoon energy and aesthetic drawing.
Yeah, that elasticity.
Right. So when he takes that same commitment to maximalist energy, that elasticity, and applies it to serious fact-based biographies, think about Margaret Sanger, Zora Neale Hurston, these complex, controversial women, does that visual elasticity maybe translate into a kind of elasticity of perspective too? A willingness, maybe even a necessity, to embrace ambiguity and different viewpoints when looking at history?
Does the style influence the substance, even in nonfiction? A great question to ponder. Thanks for diving deep with us today.
If you love to travel, Capital One has a rewards credit card that's perfect for you. With the Capital One Venture X card, you earn unlimited double miles on everything you buy. Plus, you get premium benefits at a collection of luxury hotels when you book on Capital One Travel. And with Venture X, you get access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. Open up a world of travel possibilities with the Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.